This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Everyone is kind of holding their breath to see what happens next, whether this will escalate into real fighting around Tripoli, whether the LNA will back down, whether Tripoli militias and others will capitulate to the LNA. It's really a case of waiting and seeing what will happen next.
That's Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis, on the push by General Khalifa Haftar's forces towards Tripoli. Details next. Also, Boeing admits that an erroneous activation of an autopilot assist system occurred in the Ethiopian plane crash last month, and Sunday marks the 25th anniversary of Rwanda's genocide. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, in an effort to head off new violence in Libya, today the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres met with General Khalifa Haftar, commander of the Libyan National Army. Haftar's forces have moved to less than 40 kilometers from Tripoli in an operation he says is aimed at purging the city of terrorists. Forces loyal to the internationally recognized government in Tripoli have battled back and stalled the advance of Haftar's troops. The operation comes just days ahead of a UN-planned national conference to reach a roadmap for a political solution to the country's long political crisis. The UN Security Council meets later today to discuss the military escalation in Libya. The U.S. and its allies say they oppose any military action and will hold accountable any faction that precipitates further civil conflict. Rhiannon Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis, spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about the consequences of Haftar's military escalation.
The timing of this move, in particular by Haftar and his forces, has taken a lot of people by surprise. We weren't expecting Haftar to actually make this move before the national conference. So the national conference is due to take place in the middle of April, in less than 2 weeks' time. And many assumptions had been that this was all designed as a power play to try and get more leverage, to try and get to convince more groups in the Tripoli area that sort of working with the LNA is the only way forward, and that the LNA is going to be the dominant power in that region. However, as you mentioned, that the rhetoric from Haftar has been this is designed to get rid of terrorists in this area. The situation on the ground at the moment is that no one really knows what is happening. No one knows if the LNA intends to really try and move on Tripoli militarily. The logic would say this would be a very bad idea. It would be very difficult for the LNA to militarily take the city. But at the moment, really, the situation is that everyone is kind of holding their breath to see what happens next, whether this will escalate into real fighting around Tripoli, whether the LNA will back down, whether Tripoli militias and others will capitulate to the LNA. It's really a case of waiting and seeing what will happen next.
Haftar's spokesperson denied that marching towards Tripoli came after a green light from an Arab country, reference to a recent meeting between Haftar and Saudi King Salman. What do you make of that?
Yeah, so it's been interesting that Haftar met with, as you mentioned, the Saudi royal family last week, which was significant, the fact that Haftar is engaging at the highest state level with a foreign power, given that he, in theory, is a military leader. He's not a political leader. He doesn't have an official position within the Libyan state. And so... yeah, the reason that Masmari has had to come out and say it's not driven by external influence is that many people are suspecting that in this meeting, Haftar had a green light from the Saudis and potentially others to say, OK, if you move militarily on Tripoli or say that you are going to and make those movements, then we will support you and we will give you the kind of political and international legitimacy. And it may well be that...
further civil conflict. Would the international community be able to halt General Haftar's military move?
The short answer to that is no, not really. The timing, as I mentioned, of this Haftar advance is significant. It's taken most of the international community and the UN by surprise. The kind of announcement of this move on Tripoli was made while the UN Secretary General was in Tripoli. So that's a very symbolic movement. And part of the problem is that he really has been accepted or has been in meetings, has been brought into this UN political process. You know, so we've seen lots of statements where they're saying we don't support a military solution, it has to be a political solution. These are the same type of statements they make all the time and have done for the last few years in Libya. The importance is do they take any action and do they single out Haftar and the LNA? If they do, that could be significant and it could lead to Haftar realizing that actually if he pursues any kind of significant military move on Tripoli, he could lose his international legitimacy and clout. But in terms of actual kind of practical steps, it's very difficult to see what power the UN and other nations have on the ground to stop this kind of escalation, given that it's also just 10 days before the UN National Conference, and it could mean an end to that process, really.
That was Urianan Smith, managing editor of the London-based Libya Analysis, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shinawi. Aircraft manufacturer Boeing agrees with a preliminary report on the March 10th Ethiopian Airlines crash, which says a system that was designed to prevent stalling malfunctioned, leaving the pilots to fight unsuccessfully to keep the plane from nosediving into the ground. The same issue with the so-called MCAS system apparently plagued another Boeing 737 MAX 8 jet that crashed in Indonesia in October. Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg says the company is working on a software fix, saying it's Boeing's responsibility to eliminate this risk.
The full details of what happened in these two accidents will be issued by the government authorities in the final reports. But with the release of the preliminary report of the Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302 accident investigation, it's apparent that in both flights, the maneuvering characteristics augmentation system, known as MCAS, activated in response to erroneous angle of attack information.
The preliminary report is based on information from the aircraft's flight recorders, which show that a sensor malfunctioned soon after takeoff, triggering MCAS when it was not needed. The pilots disengaged the system three times to try to gain altitude. Instead, the plane crashed and all 157 people on board died. The MAX 8 is Boeing's new update of its workhorse 737. The MAX 8 and 9 planes have been grounded until the problem is resolved. Sunday marks the 25th anniversary of Rwanda's genocide, and the country is marking the event by looking back at the causes and trying to prevent a recurrence, either in the country or anywhere in the world. VOA's Edward Ruima talks from Kigali with my colleague Paul Alexander about how Rwanda has changed, fostered reconciliation, and is building for the future.
Throughout this week in Rwanda, they've been in preparations towards the 25th genocide commemoration. Since yesterday, Kigali has been hosting an international conference on genocide, whereby close to 500 genocide scholars and researchers were meeting to discuss, reflect, and also try to find out how they can preserve the memory of genocide, as well as taking into account what happened in Rwanda, and to see that that doesn't happen anywhere in the world. Several people spoke about other potential genocides, for example, in Myanmar, and also crimes against humanity in countries like Syria. So that's what is happening right now. And in different parts of the country, they've also been burying remains of the victims of genocide who were found early this year.
So what is the mood in Kigali right now?
Well, the mood in Kigali is one of remembrance. Kigali is expecting to host several heads of states, mostly from the West African countries. The Belgian Prime Minister, Charles Michel, is also expected here. You remember that 10 Belgian peacekeepers were killed here in Kigali, the ones who are protecting the then Prime Minister Agathe Uwilingiyimana. Other senior officials, they also include the Canadian Governor General. You remember that the Canadian General, Romeo Dallaire, was the one who was heading the UN forces that requested reinforcement, but unfortunately the UN never responded to his request. So the mood is one of remembrance, at the same time reflecting on what happened. I spoke to a few young Rwandans who were born after the genocide. They didn't get affected by the genocide, but they're eager to see Rwanda moving forward rather than being dragged by what happened in 1994.
So how does the future look for Rwanda right now?
Well, Rwanda has changed a lot. Every single time I come to Rwanda, the last time I was here was 2017 during the elections. Every time you come to Rwanda, it's a changed country. Kigali City is a changed city. When you look at the publications, reports, either by World Bank, IMF, they consider Rwanda as one of the most progressing country, something that even Olusegun Obasanjo, the former president of Nigeria, yesterday mentioned that no other country has seen that went through what Rwanda went through that has progressed the way Rwanda has.
How has the reconciliation process gone?
The reconciliation process, I would say, it has gone pretty well. People I spoke to, they say that they're ready to forgive but not forget. But again, they won't be dragged by the past, and they're looking forward to a progressive Rwanda whereby Rwandans see themselves in the mirror of Rwandans rather than being or seeing themselves as through the mirrors of ethnicity. But again, there are also still challenges whereby we've read and heard so many other people who consider that there was double genocide in Rwanda. Some think that there was also a Hutu genocide. But when you look at what happened exactly in Rwanda, the massacre against the Tutsis was targeted, planned, and that's why most people call it the genocide against the Tutsis.
That was VOA's Edward Ruima talking from Kigali with VOA's Paul Alexander. As the 25th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide approaches on Sunday, we are bringing you a series of deeply moving profiles of men, women, and children who survived that terrible time. They are talking about the lives they lost, the lives they found, and their hope for a new and better Rwanda. Today, in the Survivors series, we hear from Innocent Kabirizi, who was 26 when his mother and 7 siblings were killed. Kabirizi, who was shot in the thigh as he tried to flee the killers and still limps from the wound, lives with his wife and 2 children. He is a farmer and livestock breeder and occasionally supervises community development activities in a program aimed at eradicating poverty and encouraging rural growth and social protection. But he is happy that he has been hired as a local leader after surviving a situation when the government encouraged people to wipe out their fellow citizens. He now works to give equal opportunity to all.
The night of April 6th to 7th, when Habyarimana's plane crashed, in the morning, local leaders gave orders that no one should go out. They ordered us all to stay at home. Massacres here at Nyamirabu started on the 7th. In Hirahamwe, militia launched their attacks with guns and grenades. We then decided that whoever could had to run into Gishwari Forest. Some of us managed to run away and escaped, but others were killed on the spot. There were some who were killed along the way or inside Gishwari Forest. Others were killed in the valley trying to cross the border. The first reason is that they remind me friends of my generation and classmates, some of whom were killed in my presence, others were killed elsewhere that I do not know. The other reason is that some members of my family too were killed in that first attack on the 7th. Though I was running, I saw how they killed them. We even tried to come back to bury them in the night. But we could not find them as their bodies were thrown in mass graves or latrines. Since 1994, after the genocide, I encountered many problems. I was in distress every day when I thought about relatives or neighbors that we lost. I had a family of 8 people, but none of them survived except me and my sister that you see sitting here. My children are in school, they are in their final year now. Though my relatives were exterminated, I managed to pay school for my children using the piece of land as well as caring for my family. I forgave someone, the one who took part in hunting me. I forgave him and we have reconciled. He's now a friend of mine and pays me visits. Here in Kanzenze, we have achieved unity and reconciliation, and all Gachacha court cases were completed. But for me in particular, I have forgiven the one who got involved in exterminating my family. We visit each other, we share everything. I even employ him in VIUP works.
That was Innocent Kabirizi, a survivor of Rwanda's genocide 25 years ago. You're listening to African News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. General Khalifa Haftar, commander of the Libyan National Army, has ordered his forces to march towards Tripoli, claiming he would purge terrorists. Aircraft manufacturer Boeing agrees with a preliminary report on the March 10th Ethiopian Airlines crash, which says a system that was designed to prevent a stall malfunctioned. And Sunday marks the 25th anniversary of Rwanda's genocide. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. The U.S. Africa Command backtracked today on its claim that U.S. airstrikes in Somalia had caused no civilian fatalities, saying new information showed that a woman and a child were killed in an attack on Al-Shabaab militants. General Thomas Waldhauser, head of the African Command, ordered a review of U.S. airstrikes after human rights group Amnesty International claimed last month that as many as 24 civilians had been killed or wounded in 5 attacks. The command said today that the 2 deaths occurred in a strike that was not among those listed by Amnesty International. Instead, it said Al-Shabaab militants were believed to be the only people in a vehicle that was hit, but that the new information showed that the woman and child had gotten into it. Deadly floodwaters from Cyclone Idai killed at least 800 people when the storm hit Mozambique, Zimbabwe, and Malawi last month. Hundreds of thousands of people were safely evacuated, but countless farm animals were lost. The livestock that survived, key to many people's welfare, are vulnerable to disease. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre that the international animal welfare charity World Animal Protection is working to save tens of thousands of farm animals at risk in Malawi.
Floodwaters from Cyclone Idai in early March forced thousands of people in southern Malawi into evacuation camps, but their animals, including cattle, goats, pigs, and chickens, were left to fend for themselves. Authorities say at least 15,000 farm animals were killed in the floods. In the West Hitchire Valley area, more than 4,000 farm animals were washed away. Edwin Kulungu is the area's chief animal health and livestock development officer. He says the flooding also exposes the surviving animals to diseases.
during the time of these floods, most animals' collars are flooded and there's mud. And we end up having animals staying in the mud overnight and days. And this brings diseases, wounds such as foot rot. And during this time, there's a lot of build-up of insects, which end up biting the animals and transmitting diseases from one animal to another.
The charity World Animal Protection is working in flood-hit areas of Malawi to stop the spread of disease among livestock. The group's disaster response officer to Africa, Victor Dorotichi, says they are supplying much-needed medicine and vaccines.
Basically, what they're doing is we provide treatment to animals that are sick. We also do control of internal and external parasites and also provide some medication for food conditions.
Dorotichi says they worked with the veterinary department of Malawi's Minister of Agriculture to so far treat about 30,000 farm animals. But veterinarian Nkulungo says the program has struggled for access because of damaged roads and bridges. This has left many flood-affected animals without needed medical care.
Especially areas like in Makanga, whereby we couldn't manage to pass. If ever we have to use the other road, but that road again, Eastern Bank, most of the rivers, there's a lot of water, we couldn't pass.
Malawi's livestock farmers in East Bank, like Lakson Moffat, say their animals need more help.
Ngakhale za joga kupita kuntunda zili pa jopheza zoti zikhoza kuyamba kudwala
kuma. He says although they have managed to transfer them to higher ground, there is high risk of developing foot and mouth disease and eventually infecting others. We are appealing to well-wishers who bring relief items here to also bring some free medication for these animals, says Moffat. Malawi's veterinary department says it will bring more medicines to animals in hard-to-reach areas once flood waters recede. Meanwhile, World Animal Protection says it will soon begin treating livestock in neighboring Zimbabwe and Mozambique, where Cyclone Idai hit first. The tropical storm was the worst to hit southern Africa in decades, killing hundreds of people and swamping entire villages. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nick Ivanov, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Press Conference USA. Next up, mass protests akin to those during the Arab Spring of 2011 have rocked both Algeria and Sudan. How are they different, and do they portend an opening for greater democracy and economic justice? We'll talk with Michelle Dunn about Algeria and Sudan next on Press Conference USA, Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
Stand up!